This episode of Super Pulp Science is brought to you by Krampus Is My Boyfriend, a teen fantasy webcomic written and drawn by S.M. Biko. It's the 2020 Aurora Award winner for Best Graphic Novel. Go to KrampusIsMyBoyfriend.com to catch up on the series.
Attention, citizens! It's time for Super Pulp Science!
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. Joining me today are Dan Vetterbunker, our producer extraordinaire, and my long-suffering co-host, Justin Curry, also known as Chasing Artwork, who has assured me that if I ask him live what we'll be talking about today, we'll come up with something great.
How dare you try to plan this podcast in advance? That's not how we do things.
I was very confused by when he started like asking, wait, I want to figure out what we're talking about. I'm like, you never do that.
No. Come on.
I thought I would try a new like direction towards professionalism, but as only one out of three contributing voices, I've listened to the Democratic, constituency here, and I have yielded the floor to Justin, who is going to ask the first question of the podcast.
You're working on some, it's almost like a little departure from your normal style. I'm really digging it, like between the new robots with like all the really intricate guts and the ladies who look like they're wearing those robots' guts as hair. What's going on with the new little style experiment?
That's exactly what it is. It's a style experiment. I have been over the last sort of, well, basically 3 weeks after the lockdown began, I went through this period of ennui where I was like, didn't know, art wasn't providing to me that release that it had normally done. And I realized it was because it did not represent the new frontier that it often did. So normally when we make things, however it turns out, it's a reason for us to travel, to go places, have some brand new adventure. And so no matter my relationship with the work itself, I was always able to transmute that into some other great experience. But just working the same way I'd always worked nonstop at home meant that I was losing some of that gusto. So I started this project where I said to myself, I really love doodling. And I mean like legitimately, just like little quick doodles in my sketchbook. And I said to myself like, okay, so I'm just gonna spend like 3 weeks where the only work I do that's illustrative is I'm gonna doodle. I'm just gonna doodle for no reason when it's like work day, when it's work time, whatever. It was really hard to put a schedule together in those early days. So I was gonna doodle a lot in the side and just use that as a like a way out. And I started doodling these little robot parts and wires and little bits. And I had no real thought as to what they were. I was just sort of, I was like, oh, it's like I'm building the guts of a machine, I thought after three or four pages. So I just kept building one component at a time as a little like 4 or 5 second doodle, like a little closed line. And then I started, the practice became, what could I make this into that might be fun? So I would, rather than scan them or copy them or any of that, I just went super low tech. I would just take pictures with my phone of those doodles. And then I would adjust the line weights. I would just import that photo straight from my phone into Photoshop. Adjust the plane on it so it became flat again, because I often just took a, like such a half-ass phone photo that it was all skewed. Flatten it, adjust the line weight so it all matched and took out anything that wasn't a line, like paper texture, thing like that. And then I just started moving that around and building things almost like endless Lego collage, and built what to me felt like the heart of a machine. And probably because we were talking about Dragon Nanny and I had been rereading Cassian Tonk and Rust and Water, and it was just like the machine parts were on my mind. I built this heart of a machine and I thought, wow, that's so complicated. You could never draw that over and over again. And then I realized if I grouped those assembled collages into little components, then I could actually adjust the perspective on them, and I could get sort of three or four perspectives out of the same collections of illustrations. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I can make a machine in three dimensions just by doodling things a bit at a time with no plan, assemble them for fun, and then maybe it's something else. And then I put arms and legs on it, and it was a robot. And I didn't want to do any real background. So I thought, what is a thing that has the simplest background to doodle? And Mobius is like famous for his like desert scene background comics where the foreground character is super complicated, but the background is really easy. I was like, what's something like that? I'm like, the moon. I'll put this robot on the moon. And then I don't have to draw any backgrounds or any human other elements. I'll just have this robot on the moon. And then, you know, real fast forward a couple of months, I've got all these moon drawings, these robots on the moon drawings. Well, he has to fight something. He looks a little bit like a knight. Knights fight dragons. I'll make some moon dragons. And then a couple of months after that, it was like, oh, my poor lonely knight. He has no one to talk to. So I started creating other little characters in spacesuits. And then I thought, there's one kind of story that I've never tried to do. So I'd built all these assets and I still don't know what it was, but I made a list of stories I'd never told. And I'd never, on that list was a love story. I'd never explicitly tried to tell a love story where like the point of the story is the relationship of the characters and their feelings towards one another. But I had these great genre elements where I was drawing dragons and robots and so I put a female love interest on there, created a villain for a love triangle, and just started for no reason. One of the things I've done that I've never done before is I'm creating in Photoshop the midground, foreground, and background elements with essentially like a PNG. But if you leave the bottom layer of Photoshop blank, you can export it into InDesign identically as a PNG. So I started assembling pages.
As the Photoshop document as itself.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so because this was for nobody and it was just for me playing around, I started mixing and matching pages and sort of writing a story for myself. And I didn't want to spend all this time drawing it. So I was just reusing and layering and reusing and layering and just sort of like telling this soap opera story with the foreground, midground, and background. Sometimes I'd reuse the same bunch or whatever, but it allowed me to really quickly build a book that was for no one but me. And then I'd say about 20 of the 100 pages I did, I was like, wow, these could work. Like I would spend money on a book like this. and it sort of reinvigorated me into trying to finish the other pages. I went back and I've been slowly replacing the pages that are filled with so much repeated content with new stuff, just a little at a time, just a doodle at a time. So it's been a departure from how I normally work, but it's been kind of a lifesaver in that regard also. So there's a long-winded answer to your question.
Yeah, it sounds like it's good for your mental health, this little side project.
Yeah, it's totally. It's, you know, I used to do warm-up drawings, like warm-up compositions, things like that, before I would do my have-to works. And so this has replaced that. I listened to a Cartoonist Kayfabe. Basically, it's become the book I made while listening to Cartoonist Kayfabe. And so I just listened to all these other approaches that other illustrators have had for most of their careers. They do these long shoot interviews, so really, you know, really great interviews of people who've been in the comics game a long time talking about how their style evolved. And it really just empowered me to like, okay, I'm just going to try something that's different for me. That's new for me. That's a learning curve for me. I'm doing it all in grayscale too, which is teaching me a lot about how to light a scene. I usually just cheat by adding like a lot of flare or ink splatter, or I go for, emotional tone rather than actual lighting in most of my comics up until now. So this is an excuse to put a actual practical light source in a scene and try to put the shadows where they're supposed to be, which has been interesting. Shout out to Donovan Yasek, who, when I sent him a few pics of what I've been working on, immediately asked me if those gray layers were separate. I was like, why? He's like, well, because that way a colorist can do a better job. It's essentially, I'm paraphrasing, but He pointed out like some real obvious areas where I need to build up a little bit, I think. Just by what he didn't say, more than what he did say. Donovan is a very skilled colorist, so he takes that seriously.
Daryl is not, well, he never was completely human.
What?
So it's just been a fun diversion as a way to take the extra time I've got and try to build a skill set I didn't have before.
All the extra and take, time you have?
You know, well, you know what I mean. It's like, it's the extra time that you don't know what to do. It's like 15 minutes here and there, you know, scattered around that normally I would figure out a way to leave the house so that all those times arrive in one bulk installment. But since I don't have a bulk installment of time, I've just been doing a little at a time in these little doodles, sketchbook doodles. I filled a whole bunch of these. Remember those Italian notebooks we got?
Italian
notebooks? Yeah, they were at that little art store. I think we were in Portland. I'm not sure where we were. But San Diego. You spotted them on the spinner rack. They were all these colored. They're like orange and yellow.
Yeah, I've got the green one.
That's, yeah, you got that one.
Dragon Nanny.
Yeah, they're all made in Italy. I'm trying to find the brand on it. It's Fabrino. Fabrino.
Yeah, I absolutely love these. I need to get more. So we should maybe order some bulk for the studio because...
I had bought 4 or 5 of them. I've filled up every one. I'm on my last one right now with these doodles. Like I've just just endlessly filled this thing up. Just like. And what's interesting too, from a standpoint of drawing is I do like, here's a whole bunch of circuits that I did. I mean, obviously the viewer can't see this, but Justin is not in my, isn't actually present. So I'm holding it up to the camera for him to see. You know, I'll say like, okay, what's his foot going to look like? And then I'll draw like 25 bottom treads for no other reason than it's fun to not have to decide right away.
Those could also be head designs depending on how,
how you look at it.
Yeah.
I've drawn more mechanical finger joints than ever in my life before too. They could also be, I guess, robot phalluses.
Now, how do you guys, so let me ask you this. How do you know how to draw this stuff without having any kind of engineering background? Like, you guys don't actually know how robots work.
Oh, I'm sure none of it, like, if an engineer really tried to take a careful look at things, nothing would work. It would grind into a mess, like, as soon as it started trying to move. Yeah,
well, it's interesting because that's a great question, I think, Dan, because the methodology I approach, I think, is from an anatomy standpoint. Okay. I decide what the skeleton is, and then I say, okay, it needs so many organs. What do they do? Right. So the ones that do certain things, at least in this case, because I built the robot literally from the inside out, there are softer organs and harder organs within this like layered skin of this dude. And then I put armor over top of it. And when I was showing it to our friend James Gillespie, who is the art director over at Canada's History Magazine, he was laughing. He's like, why would you do so much work on the inside of this robot just to cover it up with all this armor bits? But that was at the beginning where the assumption was that I'm just not going to show the inside, but I've sort of built a story that lets me show the bits. But it's also about form and shape, right? Like to answer your question in a specific art answer, all I'm doing is I really like S curves, Dan. The S curve is so fun to draw. It's so relaxing to make as a mark. And so for me, extrapolating the S curve, two S curves really close together become a wire, right? And two S curves far away become a piece of metal plate that goes on top of the robot. So I've just been doing a lot of S curve doodles essentially, and then figuring out how they look like something and then refining it after it's something. So it starts as just a straight up, like, you know how when we used to have phones with cords and you couldn't leave, and so you get trapped somewhere and you just doodle on whatever was around you? I'm just turning those levels of doodles into very complicated drawings. It's also inspired by a lot of the work that Justin does in a certain way, because he does this shattered vector thing where, you know, he'll take a sharp piece of glass, essentially, of digital blue fragment, and use it as a way to inform an entire illustration by just repeating the shape. And so this is kind of like, whether he knew it or not, my invisible apprenticeship at his elbow, watching how some of that stuff builds together.
Saw how
I specifically didn't want it
into a lot.
That's right. Well, I also didn't want to have it be human at all. So I made his arms super long and his legs really bow-legged. And I just was so done. I had to do this series of illustrations for another project that till the NDA is done, I can't really talk about. But the a lot of really human shapes, just super duper people. And I was so done with drawing proper anatomy that I wanted to do something that was just like wild and weird. And so it gave me this chance to do that on my moon robot. But then I was like, I wonder if this drawing style will work with real people. And so I made his love interest not another robot, but a woman. And it's just been fun to deconstruct essentially soap opera language into science fiction language, which has also been kind of a fun exchange. Not something I would normally spend time with, but because I don't, it becomes a real challenge to try and play with those tools.
Well, it's good to always get out of your comfort zone every once in a while, right? Not do the same thing over and over again. That's good.
I think so, yeah. And
you did that recently, Justin, with your portraits that you posted. You did those portraits for those people at the gym, hey?
Yeah, like I find when I do things outside my comfort zone, it's usually when other people ask me.
Okay.
It's all my...
You're not doing it voluntarily.
Yeah. And then it's kind of like, I think that keeps with my own personal stuff kind of fresh and exciting, that I'm not doing it all the time. I'm taking breaks to do other people's projects and then coming back to mine. I think left alone with my own stuff for too long, I'd get a little burnt out of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. No, it does. Well, and it was an external, you know, it's funny you say that someone else has to ask you to do it. In our case, I was organizing some stuff in the library here and I found some old comics that I had done, some black and white drawing, like no digital elements to it at all, that I had done back in 2006, 2005, something like that, that I had made by hand. And they were on the shelf and my son was like, "Hey dad, what are these?" And I was like, "Oh, those are comics I made." And he was like, "You made this? You don't draw like this at all. This isn't your style. This isn't." And I'm like, "Oh, I draw like that all the time, just only for myself." And it was like, he helped me rediscover a way I used to draw also, which I think added to the reason why I found it fun. It was like, you know, you get starved for external gratification when you're trapped at home, if you're a creative person who's used to being on the road, putting your stuff in people's faces. So just this tiny little flicker of my own child being like, "Hey, these aren't half bad. People might like it," was just enough to put me back on the path of using a pen and a piece of paper again, instead of all these fancy digital tools. I mean, I still have to, I can't assemble the finals without Photoshop, but it gives me a place to start wherever I am. Yeah. So if I ever get back on a plane again, Justin, I'm going to be making these books like crazy.
There you go. Time.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. How about you, Mr. Vadabon Kerr?
What's up?
I noticed that you're doing a lot of tricks on your other podcast.
Like what?
Have you... Well, you do a lot more like audio transitions. You do a lot more like inserting guests into a larger conversation or like an excerpt from another place.
It's more, what I would say, it's a little more, it's segmented. There are regular segments. There are repeating segments. Every show has a certain amount. We kind of just go, and then this one I talk, and then I put little sounds into transition or to just break up the talking a little bit. But for that one, I actually use music to transition between segments. And yeah, we're doing a lot more guest interviews this season as well. It's I love it. That's like the best part of this, because I get to talk to people from all over the world. I interviewed a guy in Australia last week. And it's about these like classic video games that I love so much. This guy, his name is Sega Master Tim. And it's awesome. I found him on Twitter. He was a games counselor in Australia. I didn't know they had this in Australia. I knew they had it here. Like, we had the Nintendo line. You would call the Nintendo line. Remember that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And get help with your video games. This is before we had the internet. This is what we had to do and get help. So, and it would be like $3 a minute or something stupid like that. If your parents caught you doing it, you'd be in big trouble. Oh, yeah. So anyway, this guy did that in Australia. That was his job for 5 years. He worked, and it was for Sega, not Nintendo. And I don't remember there being a Sega one here in North America, but there must have been if they did it in Australia as well. And he was great. And then from there, he kind of rekindled his, like he said, he went to a con a couple years ago, and that rekindled his love of classic video games. He started collecting again. He is working on a complete Sega Master System collection of video games. He only needs 4 games to complete his collection, so that's really interesting as well. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I really enjoyed doing that podcast. These guys are, you know, everyone loves the video games and loves talking about them, and it's a lot of, and I mean, we're all men. It's mostly dudes. I mean, I know a lot of women like play video games as well, but so far it's just been dudes.
You swear you never played this before?
I don't think so.
Right. But for all you know, you could have invented pole position.
The reason I bring it up is because it feels like you're flexing some new muscles as far as building that audio landscape.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about getting outside your comfort zone and trying new things, absolutely, I've been doing that. Mostly out of necessity. I have to learn how to record all of our segments are done remotely. Like, there's no more in-person recording, which is what we used to do. And so I have to figure out how to record on Zoom the way we're using it right now. I have to figure out how to connect with somebody and reach out and that kind of stuff. And yeah, I'm working on different types of transitions, different types of sounds and that kind of thing as well. So it's been a lot of fun, and they give me pretty much free rein to do what I want on that podcast. So I really enjoy that.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been, you know, I've been talking to lately a lot of people. Like, I had an interesting late night call with a bunch of fellow writers, and so many of them trying projects that they would never have tried before, because in their day-to-day, work-a-day, busy schedule, you just couldn't justify it. And they're justifying it from the standpoint of just their own mental health, right? Like, they just can't be alone, or, you know, some of them just live by themselves or whatever, or they're just cooped up, that they just need to have invented a challenge for themselves. And so it was kind of interesting because, you know, it was like, oh, it's not just me, you know, to hear that all these people are trying these other genres and these other, you know, ways of expressing themselves, you know, writers who are painting now for the first time, you know, mm-hmm. Even Justin working on a prose novel, you know, just everyone just trying something new for just because you can, or maybe you should.
It's so important for development, getting outside your comfort zone like that is so valuable. And that's part of, like, most of what we're doing in our first year of our program in Red River College is just that, getting our students outside the comfort zones. Then we can work on other stuff. But that's, like, first of all, if we can get them to walk up to a complete stranger, I know we can't do it right now, but normally we would get them to walk up to a complete stranger and ask questions. They're terrified of that. But they do it, right? By the end of the semester, they're doing it. Justin, go ahead. You had something you were going to say.
As far as writing that book, like, I think a couple of podcasts ago, we talked about, I was, NaNoWriMo kind of got me fired up about it. I did not like complete the NaNoWriMo. I think I'm somewhere around the 20,000 word mark. So I didn't quite get halfway.
That's still pretty good.
But I did, I got things started, and then I'm getting numbers together to get quotes from Friesens about printing the book. And then I've also started concept arting. It's going to be like a novel with, like, kind of not graphic novel, but a whole bunch of, like, concept art of the mechs in the novel are going to be kind of scattered throughout. So it's going to be 80% writing, 20%, 25% illustration. And so I've gotten a bunch of that stuff together as well. And it's, I think it kind of takes some of the heavy lifting away from the writing, because I know I can insert a illustration that tells a good chunk of the story instead of having to rely on my, you know, underdeveloped writing skills to get things across. I can rely on my more practiced illustration work to kind of, yeah, show the reader what's going on. So I'm really excited about that project, and excited about trying out the new format and departure from what I normally do, trying new things.
Yeah, what I think you're going to find as you're putting that draft together is how surprised you'll be by the moments that only a couple of really well-crafted paragraphs can make clear to the reader, that even an illustration can only do what an illustration does. And there's a magic in proper prose that just, you know, there's a reason it's a whole other skill set. You're going to really enjoy that feeling. We're like, wow, I could never draw this.
Right.
Feeling that this gets across, right? And it'll be those things. I mean, there are other artists that maybe could, you know, but you'll find the balance, the equilibrium between your pictures and your words. Something when it happens the right way, just is like the greatest feeling ever. Like as I'm putting a project together, I'm just like, ooh, this is the moment, right? Like this is what only words can tell, right?
Right.
And I think it's cool that you are looking at self-publishing. It's great that you're in a position that you're able to do that, because a lot of people would be like, write it and then put it up on the shelf and wait for a publisher, or maybe they'd obviously send it to publishers and stuff like that, but you don't need that. You can just go ahead and publish that. And you already have an existing audience for your other work that will likely try this out as well. Right.
Yeah. And I think, the other kind of treading into new ground project that I'm excited about for 2021 is I wanted to get into enamel pin printing.
Ah, yes.
It's been on my list for a long time. So I thought it'd be kind of neat to tie this novel, which are usually like around what, like $10, $12 for a book in the bookstore, right? Something like that.
Yeah, anywhere between 12 and
Not for brand new ones. Like brand new ones are more expensive. Hardcovers are more expensive. But even if it's a soft cover,
Like a soft cover novel. Yeah. And then,
but at
like
20,000 words, you're going to be in around that space. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah.
For like a detailed enamel pin, a lot of pins also range around the $10 to $15 mark as well. So I thought if I did the novel and then I did some cool robot enamel pins to maybe try to do that in tandem, because I don't know if I'm necessarily reaching the right crowd to sell a bunch of novels. But if I have this cool new pin experiment that's tied in with the novel, I think that that helps me reach my audience a lot more. So I'm kind of, relying on old, more comfortable sources of revenue to try out this new experiment with.
Well, the enamel pins are popular. I'll tell you that. My son is starting to build a collection of enamel pins. And it's not just of like, usually you get them at like souvenir shops and that kind of stuff, but he's ordering them. Like he wants, for some of his favorite YouTubers, he wants they're offering enamel pins as a merchandise item on their website. So he just wants that. He doesn't want a t-shirt or a poster or anything. He wants an enamel pin and he wants to kind of build a collection of them. So that's really cool. Yeah.
I still don't know why T-shirts are so tricky to do.
Yeah, I don't know why. It's I guess because it's like a very common item that everybody wears at some point. But it's tough to get good T-shirts for sure.
Yeah, and the enamel pin, you know, is this interesting space. You know, it comes every 20 years. Enamel pins have their resurgence.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. But what they are in this day and age is the thing that costs nothing to ship.
Yeah.
They're a tangible recreation of a specific work of art. They're, you know, beautiful. They're durable. And they're relatively inexpensive to produce and super inexpensive to ship. So they become this thing that if you're trying to you're a YouTuber, right?
Yeah.
Trying to monetize your fame is a little bit tricky, right? You can't constantly rely on your YouTube click revenue. Having something tangible, but that people can send you $25 for is a pretty smart thing.
That's a pretty expensive enamel pin.
A child with a stick of chewing gum has just rendered your $100 million worth of hardware useless. Any suggestions?
Okay, I have to go on a little mini rant about shipping things right now. So my foil store is open right now.
You have 11 minutes.
And okay, I can do it in like four. So I've learned some lessons, which include if I'm shipping anything outside North America, It can't be in a flat package that could be damaged during shipment. Everything's in a solid tube now. So especially like when it's going to, I'm getting a lot of orders from Germany for some reason and Australia. And if I don't think a flat package would get there safely. So I got a bunch of tubes to ship there. And so I'm putting together some shipments for Australia. And if I were to send it flat, like in a flat package for a print, I think it's around like $35. And that gets it there, like not in 12 weeks. It gets it there in a reasonable time, something like that. And then as soon as you go to a tube, that jumps to $90 to get it there in a, right? Okay, but hold on. So $90 to send it there in a tube that arrives in like the year 2020. But then if you take a piece of, I have these square boxes, these long square boxes. And so I cut a section of that off and fit the tube inside of it. So now it's a square box. And now it's $35 again to send it. What? As soon as it's a rollable tube, it falls into this like extraordinarily expensive category. And I don't quite understand why, because the box, the exact same size with four corners, is like less than half the price.
Weird. Maybe because that's exactly why. Maybe because it's round, it's a pain in their ass. But that box can stack with other boxes in the truck, in the cubes, in the delivery, in the drop shipments. Those round ones, you know, they're round and they're stronger as a result. But maybe that's
roll around or something. I don't know. That's weird.
So I have all these tubes, and now it's really much worth my time to like make them into fake boxes so I can ship them for far, far cheaper. And it just blew my mind, the price difference.
So your cloaking device, you have to put a cloaking device.
I kind of expected the ladies in the room to give me a look or raise a bit of a fuss, because it's not covering the entire cylinder. It's very clearly a cylinder that's been shoved into a square sleeve and a bunch of the cylinder is still sticking out. But it's fine. Not going to roll around.
Oh my goodness.
That's amazing. They have? You think there'd be enough things being shipped by tube these days? By the way, they should have a better. Speaking about shipping by tube, don't you think it's about time we brought in a giant pneumatic tube system for all this?
Yeah.
Let's just build a giant pneumatic tube system so we can just shove it in there and it goes to wherever.
I just want that sound that pneumatics make.
That's right. Boom. Yeah, that's awesome. But you'd think that they would ship enough things in those tubes that they would have a way to store them on the truck or in the plane or whatever. Like I'm envisioning like some netting or something with little pockets in it that you can kind of stick the tubes
UPS,
in there.
UPS, if you're listening, Dan Vaderbanker would like to work as a consultant.
No, I don't. No, I don't.
Next generation tube shipping system.
Let's make it FedEx.
Can we just pause for a moment and recognize that what we're discussing is the annoyance of shipping something to Australia? Like, that's amazing.
Don't get me wrong. I think it is incredible. And I think, like, it gets a bad rap for such a magical system.
Pun intended?
No, I don't think it was.
No. Bad rap. Okay, yeah. No, I get it. I get it.
That was just a Zoom delay. It's starting to affect his humor also.
Yeah. No, it's pretty crazy that you can sit in your house and within a couple of weeks you could have packages all over the world affecting other people.
Well, I've also been noticing as a comics guy, right? Like there's comics that I, not comics specifically, but collections mostly. I don't order individual comics online like ever unless they're somebody's like a zine or something. If you're willing to buy the used copy, it's almost like they're paying you to get it out of there. So like, for example, I was looking for a collection of Jeff Darrow's Big Guy and Rusty the Boy Robot. Jeff Darrow's just, if you don't know, if you're listening to us and you don't know about Jeff Darrow, Google Jeff Darrow and just look at that artwork. It's mind blowing, but I didn't have a collection of it. So a new collection of it or a mint condition copy of it, you could run you $90, $150 online. But a used version where like it's, they have pictures of it. It's like the books I all, like all the books behind me just meant it was read by someone and you can tell. $13 free shipping. Well, like, get it the hell out of my warehouse is more or less what they, right? So
aren't there some items in the studio though that you would just like, you would put on the store and as long as they're covering the shipping, you'd probably be happy to get it out into the world?
Maybe. Now that you put it that way, I wonder, what are the things we have in this, in the storage room that we could just people to pay shipping for and they could have it?
Like, for example, I've got a fairly large inventory of retired stock that I didn't bring out, I didn't bring to Comic Cons and never really, and then another pile of stuff that just never really sold well. Like, it was experiments and I'm happy I did it, but it just never really landed. And now that I'm selling a lot of prints online, that pile is quickly getting added in as bonus artwork to everybody's orders. So it's kind of like it's added value for them and I'm happy just to throw it in as something, as a gift for a way of saying thanks. And
maybe in 2021 we should do a big promotion. We'll put like, I don't know, 50 boxes together. We could do it together so we can share the labor of it and just like throw a bunch of random stuff together and then do a shipping only promotion where it's like a grab bag of weird experiments from the studio. And but all you have to pay
is careful not to, you're riding that line of like, help us get rid of our garbage. We don't want it.
No, I don't mean garbage. I mean like, you know, like I have a bunch of short run comics that I did back in that day, like that 2005, 2009 range. You know, I don't need to haul those around to shows, but people might appreciate them. I mean, my kid liked it enough to make me want to make more. Right. So some of that stuff, some art, I've got discontinued prints that I'd happily just let people have.
I remember like back when I was younger and was into buying toys, I think it was Transformers. They had some kind of line going out where it was, you got two Transformers in the same package. But it was never two good ones. It was always one that you didn't want and one that you really wanted. And even as like a young person, I realized like they just wanted, like they're making it so you have to buy two.
Right.
I can't get the two good ones in one package. I have to buy two packages and get these other two that I don't really want. And so maybe you do it that way. You.
So what you're saying is, the disappointment you had in your childhood, we should offer to our fans.
It wasn't disappointment. I just recognized what was going on. Like nobody would buy this by itself. The only way I'm getting this is because it's with something stronger.
Well, I can tell you a story. Way back in the day, the company is closed, long ago gone, but Comic Cave on St. Mary's. When I first got involved in being in having my own comic store, it was working with the manager there at Comic Cave. And it was in the very early Wild West days of eBay, where you could put things for sale on the internet, and people would pay it and pay the shipping. And one day we were sitting around, we had cleaned up, we had taken all the posters down, you know, you got all this promotional material. So we were taking down all the old posters that they had sent you as promotions, taking down all the bookmarks, taking all this, like, you know, just, now to us, it was garbage. And we had this big pile and we were going to throw it in the garbage. This is even before the days of recycling, right? So it's just going to go in the garbage. And I said, you know, there's some poor super fan out there that would really love to have access to all the promotional material that we get sent, right? That we just throw away every month. And so he's like, all right. And he opens his eBay account and he types one bag comic store garbage contains stuff that's no good to us. Right? And then I believe he put in like a little bracket or an asterisk, no food waste, right? Like just to let people know there's no banana peels in there. He listed it on eBay. He sold it for like $70 in the early days of the Wild West, right? Because it was like a mystery pack of promotional materials that people weren't able to get their hands on. Right. And so it was literally a garbage bag that then we put in a box and then shipped.
Well, how many of those, the mystery boxes that were at every single Comic-Con became, like every little vendor had a mystery box, right? That had $30 worth of stuff in it and a chance to win a super rare, fill in the whatever blank. And how much of that was just them trying to get rid of dead stock that didn't seem to move?
Well, what they do is they're buying cards. I talked to one of the guys who was behind the one of the mystery boxes. I forget it was the one that had the like Mario or the one that had like all the anime stuff. But I talked to the main shipper and he said what he did is they buy pallets of overstock toys.
Right.
And overstock stuff that gets listed in all kinds of places. And they just buy a pallet and then it arrives in their warehouse and they divide up the pallet and they're paying pennies on the dollar for the contents. And they divide it into their mystery boxes. And he said, you know, for just retail value, you're getting exactly what you're paying for, right? The cost of the retail of the insides of that box would be roughly the same. Mm-hmm. And then he said, but the real trick is we're not allowed to do gambling at the shows. So this is our way of doing gambling because right. There's a lot of gamblers in the world. And we get to feed that. And it was so gross. Like, hearing him talk about his model for making money was like, how can we turn it into gambling?
Right.
Was, right.
Loot boxes from video games, right? It's not gambling, but.
Yeah.
Grab mom and dad's credit card and get more loot boxes.
Yeah. But all those loot crate places are done now, eh?
Yeah, they've cracked down on it because I think that joke that I just made happened a little too often that kids were buying loot crates over and over again trying to get that skin that they really wanted and racking up a bill, and it's gambling. It really is.
So how do we include gambling in our business model, Justin? That's the real question. That's where the money is. Addiction.
Yeah.
How much do you want?
You got it?
Mm-hmm.
Terrific. Give me 100. Yeah. All right. What does it say I got in there?
Oh, enough.
So one of the next projects that I'm pretty excited about, I've got a couple commissions tied to the Kickstarter that I'm going to finish up. And I've got one or two other projects that kind of take priority. I need to do like, you know, my real job for a little bit. And then when that's all done, I wanted to try an experiment where I'm building a whole bunch of modular robot pieces. So heads, torsos, arms, legs, accessories. And then in my store, when you go to buy something, you can add in a form to pick all these options. So I'm just going to post the picture of all the different elements that are available. And then when you go to buy it, you pick like this head, this torso, these arms, this color scheme, this accessory. And then 5 days later, I post what that looks like put together. So you don't get to see it
right
before. You just pick all the pieces and then I show you what it looks like when it's all put together. And I don't know if this will work or not. It's just kind of I like building things modular that I can take them apart and use them again in other pieces. And I think this might be neat. It's not quite a commission, but you do get to customize your own thing. And this also ties into like growing up. I was reminiscing about old video games that I wish I'd played more of when I was younger, and Armored Core was one of them.
Oh, and love that game.
I sucked at the game. I had Armored one of them, and I never got anywhere in the game, but all I wanted to do was customize my mech, right? That's where I spent 80% of my time, was just building the perfect mech. And it was always overweight. And it didn't, like, you know, it went over the weight capacity because all the cool things were too big for the frame I chose. Yeah. But all I did in that game was build.
That's such a great game. And you could build like a fast mat. You could basically go quick and fast and like, no, but without too much damage. Or you could just make a big tank, basically make a huge thing with giant rocket launchers. That takes a little bit longer to blow something up. But that was a phenomenal game. I just played that for hours. I loved it. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I finished it.
Dear listener, I wish you could see the fire in Dan's eyes right now.
It was literally one of my favorite games on the PlayStation. I played it every day. It's such a good game.
Which one? Because there was quite a few.
The first one was the one I was playing, yeah.
I came in later on. I think it was like one of the later ones. But there was also, this was back in the day, I think of demo discs.
Oh, yeah.
And there was something where you could download a save file from the demo disc onto your memory card, and then you had all these saved files of other built mechs.
Ah.
So I was able to get access to all these other built mechs that had all these parts that I hadn't unlocked yet. And I thought that was I was mind blown by the technology, first of all, that I could save a file that I didn't earn and then reap the benefits. And then to see all these other cool mechs that other people had built. Yeah, I don't remember playing the game really at all. I just remember building things. And so that's what I want to capture with this experiment.
That sounds like fun.
And this is also kind of inspired. Jed Henry recently did a Skyrim piece where you could customize the warrior's armor that was facing off the dragon. So you would buy the piece and you would choose your weapon and helmet and armor plating. And I thought that was genius. And I really wish I'd came up with it first, but definitely inspired by him.
So it's funny you say that. I used to draw my D&D characters in shitty pencil on lined paper, but then I would draw and then cut out elements of new armor and new stuff. And then I'd photocopy it at the school as a new, it was a new drawing, but it was the new gear, right? So you would get this flat illustration. So it's funny. And so that's what I was thinking of was I was working on these new Moon Man drawings, this modular construction. So it's similar in that vein.
Wait a minute,
but I can tell you as a consumer, that's the kind of thing I'd be into. I would spend a lot of time on a website that let me pre-build a crazy robot in your style and then pick the one that I want. I think that's a genius idea.
If it goes really well, I'd love to take it a step further and work with make some kind of interface where you can kind of loosely see it it would take a little bit more programming, and we know some people that could probably help out with that, but I want to do kind of a more basic version of this first, see how people react, see what the interest is, and if there's a lot of interest for it, I can use that as a jump, a springboard, and just build more accessories and more weapons and more options and go from there. So it's something that could just grow and grow and grow, but we'll see. You never know, right? This is one of those things. It might be, 20 hours of work that never really goes anywhere, or yeah.
I could see something like that, once you build the infrastructure to make it work, combining with your Bones Burn prose illustrated book, where it's here's the book, now design your own mech, right? If a fan of a existing property would love to remix that existing property, I think, in their own way. The same way we do those collage dragons and collage robots with kids at our book launches. Right, yeah. Where they just remix and build stuff we would never come up with out of our own pieces. I think there's what's fun is that it puts the creative element in the user's hands. So a person who doesn't know how to draw can still feel like they orchestrated something,
And I'm also really excited because I'm going to make sure everything fits, but with the color schemes and all the little, you can add rust, you can add foliage growth on your robot. You can add battle damage and wires hanging. There's going to be all these things, and I'm not going to be able to try out every option. So people are going to be able to put things together that I didn't think of and create something that I haven't, I didn't build yet. So I'm kind of excited to see, what comes out of this.
And for the sake of the listener, is it fair to say that this is really only possible with what you're doing is because you're working in Illustrator? Right, and those files let you resize it easily without losing any resolution and layer it quite easily.
So it's everything will be very carefully grouped, and then I think the magic of Illustrator that I can't really do as easily in Photoshop is Illustrator. You can select colors based you can select elements based on their color. And it's not just eyedropper color. It's what they were built with. I'm trying to make this make sense to somebody who's not familiar with the program. I can customize my colors way more in depth than I could in Photoshop, way easier. Right. So once I build it correctly, me changing like the four main colors that everything's going to be built with is going to be very, very easy.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So it's like you can give it a new paint job really easily.
The paint job will be much easier than like in Photoshop. You can still do it in Photoshop. Don't get me wrong. I think it would just be a little more involved than what I have planned. And then everything is going to be custom in the like if you pick scratches and bullet wounds and stuff like that, like I'm going to just kind of make it up as I go and add a whole bunch of little things here and there. It's not going to be just turning it on or off. Like there is still going to be some putting together. But yeah, it's totally just, I think it'd be easier to do in Illustrator than Photoshop.
Now, because it is Monday, and out of the goodness of my heart, I will pretend as if it didn't happen. But I am lousy at pretending. So if it happens again...
I've got enough work laid out for me for probably the next week or two. And then I've made a point of everybody who's asking for things, I'm not taking anything on until February next year. So kind of end like Christmas and January are just going to be mine to do what I want with, and then kind of back to things in February. They're going to be probably tricky months for everybody too, right? It's going to be cold and wintry and we might have to stay apart. So
yeah, because our numbers are going to be in an interesting place. The other thing about what I like about that whole system is that I know, like, I'm seeing this through the lens of, like, in a few, you know, maybe it's a year, but you're back in front of some people, like the fans of your work, the people who really connect with it.
Oh my God.
When they ask, what is this or what is that? And you say, oh, that's one you could customize.
I could give them like the menu sheet, like a print. So when I send this to people, they're going to get a print of their mech put together. And then they also get a print of all the options and like probably highlighted the ones they chose. So at a show, you could buy the print and like circle your options that you're picking. And then like a week after the show, I can process it. Yeah. So you're kind of buying a commission and that's like your...
Well, that's what I was leaping to, is that right? This is something that you could say, like, here's the examples, and if you want one, you can pre-purchase it now, and here's the menu, circle what you want, put your contact info. Because what I said to you immediately when you had this idea, I was like, oh man, I could do that with monsters. Like, I would love to do, like, a legitimate Frankensteining of all kinds of crazy monster stuff. So it might be a fun experiment to just try in different genres and different stuff.
Yeah. Modular projects. And I'm thinking of calling it Mecha Mecha.
No, yeah.
Kind of like a playoff Build-A-Bear. Mecha Mecha.
I think you should open a chain of stores across North America.
Yeah, so do I.
All shakes out, you can be a new type of toy store.
An IP lawyer who's listening to this right now is registering the trademark as we speak.
So I'm really excited to
You should beep it. You should just beep the name. So in the episode, I just want to hear it beep so that no one knows his great name idea.
I'm excited to come back to this podcast in a couple months and to see how that experiment panned out. I've been going back to our really early episodes, like the 20s and 30s, and just listening to what we were getting up to and the projects we were starting and all our hopes and dreams. And yeah, we were talking about FanQuest coming together. It was about to happen. Dan, you were all stressed out for FanQuest 2018.
That was a good year. That was a good one.
Yeah.
You know what's been interesting? I'll just reflect. Now, this is just three people talking to each other and ignoring our listeners. I've really appreciated the way that this has become a diary of what we hope to do and then a visitation as the follow-up. When I sneak back into older episodes, I find the same thing where it's like, oh yeah, we actually did that. But I honestly think one of the values of saying it out loud and planning it and you hold yourself to it once you've said it out loud. It's not just an idea in your head. It becomes a thing that you can point to and say, oh yeah, you know, at the beginning or at the end of 2020, we made a plan for some modular character prints, right? And then you can, you kind of held to it. You're like, well, I don't want to not do it. It's just like making a list. It's like a bullet journal, but in audio file.
When it really takes off, we're going to regret giving Jed Henry all the credit for the idea.
Yeah, I know. It's true. But credit where it's due, right? Right?
I think as soon as,
go ahead.
As soon as he posted it, I messaged him something to the tune of, I hate you for thinking of this first. That's genius. And then he said, you should do something like this for that new Cyberpunk game. He said, like, should try. Yeah.
So no, he did. I should do something for the new Cyberpunk game.
Yeah, I think we all should. I'm just hoping it's see, that's one of those things. I'm glad they're taking their time and getting it done quickly and not rushing it out the door and giving us a half-baked product.
When is that supposed to come out, that Cyberpunk game?
I don't know. When it's ready, when it's done.
They started talking about it in like 2013, didn't they?
Maybe not till 2077. No, it's like my son, my youngest, is a huge fan of Hollow Knight. We've talked about Hollow Knight before on the
podcast. Yeah.
And there's a sequel coming out, Silksong, but no indication of when it's coming out. It's an indie studio, so they're smaller. And I'm sure it's gonna be a great game, and Luke has made me promise him as soon as that comes out, I'm buying it. I'm like, sure. So
I thoroughly endorse Hollow Knight.
Because I think you might know the answer to this. Why is everybody freaking out about the PlayStation 5 right now? And
what do you mean?
Like, there's not enough PlayStation 5s out there. I get that. So people are like, there's the people that have them are really excited they have them, and everybody wants them, and there's not enough. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing on the PlayStation 5 really yet.
Well, there's on the Xbox. The new Xboxes have nothing. Literally no games. I mean, it's weird that they would launch a system with no games. The PlayStation 5 has, they've got an updated Spider-Man game with Miles Morales, so you can play that.
You can also play on the PlayStation 4.
Not the Miles Morales one, though, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
really? Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. All right, well, there you go. I don't know then. I don't know. I'm not a first generation. Like, I don't. No, generation. Sorry, I don't really buy into game systems on release. I did that once. I did that once with the Wii U, and I was burned for it. So I'm never gonna do that again. I'm gonna wait to see how the system does, and eventually.
I feel the same way about COVID vaccines. I don't want the first one on the market. I'll take the one that's a few months later.
Well, the first one is on the market today. Apparently, they're giving them out today in Britain.
To everybody.
But yeah, like, I think that, I mean, obviously it's, and actually I do know one of my co-hosts on the Games You Deserve podcast got a PS5 and he's been loving it. He says it's amazing. I mean, it's exciting to have a new system like that, but yeah, they certainly did not like go all out, and this would be the year to do it. It's been a very good year for video games. I mean, people have been staying inside and playing video games. That's what they've been doing. And so it would certainly have been a good idea to have, for them to have some better launch titles. And I think the PlayStation ones are fine. But yeah, Xbox has nothing. There's not even like a new Halo game or anything to go with it. It's kind of weird.
So
it's like Xbox rushed theirs out to match the PlayStation and didn't have the games ready for it. So
yeah, I've been seeing a lot of buzz on the internet about people wanting them, and yeah, that's been my rationale as well. Like, there's no new games when systems first come out, so I don't see what the appeal to getting it is. Yeah, wait a couple months until there's actual fun titles on it.
Yeah. Although I've heard the controller is amazing. That DualSense controller they have for that system is apparently very, very cool. So
cool.
Well, you know, our theme of our conversation today had been that it's okay to try new things. So I guess maybe we should cut the giant multi-million dollar megacorps a little bit of slack for just trying something new.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. Yeah, I guess.
They're people like the rest of us, right? If they want to follow their bliss and release a game system with no games, you know, I say let them try. Right, follow your dreams.
There was more to this story than what I was gleaming.
There usually is. Well, gentlemen, this has been Super Pulp Science, where we have talked about how all kinds of things get made. This is Gregory Kamichuk encouraging you to join the fight and make comics.